you all for being here today. It's indeed a cleansing experience when we get the chance to present in front of our ultimate judges, the students that devote their most crucial years of their lives to co-create and pursue our dreams. In this sense, I approach the opportunity that the department gave me as a way for me to clarify what we have done over the last 2 years and what deserves, if not demands, a future. To conceptualize this talk today, I will give an overview of what I have done over the last 2 decades. I immigrated to brain research in 2001. And as an immigrant, as a typical immigrant, I rushed into the field with a high confidence to knowledge ratio. And hopefully over these 17 years, this ratio decreased with gradual increases of the denominator knowledge and some modest adjustment of the numerator. So after spending two exciting yet freezing winters in Montreal, developing biomimetic algorithms that control robots, I went back to the blue skies of Greece, where I developed computational models that inform neurosurgeons about the clinical outcome of a very fragile, delicate neurosurgical procedure called deep brain stimulation. 6 days after my PhD in defense, I joined MIT, where I was given the unique chance to develop a pediatric rehabilitation robot. And I call it unique chance because this work did not, it overcame the gravitational force of the lab setting. So it didn't just solve an interesting problem, it didn't just address a toy example. The robot that you see here is being hooked up on a daily basis to 2 to 3 kids, new kids, in two hospitals, in 3 hospitals in 2 countries, Italy and the States. And it's been delivering therapy to their ankle, and for some of them it's beneficial in a sense that it provides some sensory motor therapy and helps them regain or gain their mobility. In 2013, I crossed the Charles River Bridge and went from MIT to Harvard, where I developed biophysically plausible computational models that integrate the neural to the behavior activity of the brain. And by being biophysically plausible, these models allowed us to explain the differences that we observe in the autistic brain compared to the what we would call typically developing brain. So in 2015, I settled in the mild weather here in New Jersey, where at Rutgers, I formed a team with a single goal, which is to understand biological intelligence and translate that understanding into artificial intelligence. To do so, we develop brain morphic computational methods that integrate with the brain. As all of you know, the brain is not a monolithic structure. It consists of many layers across the spatial and the temporal domains. In that sense, the word integration of our methods with the brain has 3 main directions. One is to mimic the behavior. The second is to understand the underlying mechanism that give rise to that behavior, and in the case of a deviation from normalcy, how we could restore the pathophysiology. The first 2 principal components of our goal are to understand brain function and translate that understanding by deriving computational principles from the brain to apply them into generic data analysis methods. This goal is in fact an emerging global strategic goal that is currently being addressed by governments, industry, and academia, of course. In fact, this goal is not new. 1956, von Neumann wrote, but he never had the chance to finish, it was his swan song, a set of lectures to be given at Yale that were published as a book. In these 90 pages, someone can find really interesting analogies between computation and what was then the current knowledge of how the brain works. Even before that, the usual suspect, Alan Turing, writes in his report to his director that was criticized as a schoolboy essay what will then become the prelude of artificial intelligence. In these 16 pages, Turing introduces the notion of randomly interconnected graph. And he goes one step further by proposing learning loop, reward-based learning loop, based on how the infant brain, or at least the evolution of how the infant's brain develops over the first few weeks of our life. Both these works are based on a particular principle that the neuron is the basic building block in both biological intelligence and so if someone looks at the ears, he will find a lot of examples like this, where computational methods have been derived from basic principles in brain computation. Another example is reinforcement learning. So reinforcement learning is based on the behavioral observation that the brain identifies, prioritizes, and anticipates rewards in an effort to balance between exploration of an uncharted territory and exploitation of already acquired knowledge. You would be proud to learn that this work is mainly based on one of our guys' work. There's a guy who, back in 1957, he's a Rutgers alumnus, his name is Skinner, and he conducted more than 70,000 hours of experiments on how pigeons learn to do tasks. Going one step further to today, convolutional neurons, the workhorse of deep learning today, they are very successful because they're based on a single principle that they got from the brain, which are receptive fields. In fact, receptive fields are experimentally found back in the 1950s, again, by Hubble and Grissom, who found neurons in the visual cortex of cats that are responsive to light, darkness, and patterns of light and darkness that create lines of different orientations. The problem with CNNs is their invariance. And to address this, last week, Hinton introduced reintroduced his idea of capture neural nets that have decreased the error from 20% to 12%. And to do that, Hinton himself had said that I'm inspired by microcolumns, which we knew that they exist in the brain, that is, neurons that get together to represent that in the aggregate activity of these neurons, they represent a single entity. And I have here the motor neurons, the neurons that are here, that can represent this entity moving different parts of our body. That, as you should start expecting, this idea goes again back to 1950s. So, if we are to realize our promise that we will develop brain-inspired computing, we should fill this gap here, especially because during the last 20 years, we've seen enormous amount of new knowledge about how the brain works. And the problem is even worse. If you look at the paper published recently, which is not looking at the amount of knowledge that we have now compared to what we had 30 years ago, but the amount of modalities that can help us see how the brain works. There is no comparison between what we had back in 1988 and what we have now. Now we can see more things and understand how the brain works in other perspectives that we never thought 30 years ago. The neuronal paradigm of studying the brain has dominated all fields for 100 years and has been at the forefront of emerging disciplines such as computational neuroscience and artificial intelligence. To give you an example, if someone develops a brain disease, he will be assessed by a neurologist, and if needed, he will be treated by a neurosurgeon. Like Shabar here, he's the director of Rutgers Neurosurgery Team, a good collaborator. We have a small grant together. But it's not only the traditionally conservative fields such as medicine. Even artificial intelligence is based on the dogma that brain equals neurons. There are good reasons for that. There are actually two good reasons. Neurons are electrically active cells. So we can record them. We can stick an electrode close to them, and we can record their activity as they encode, process, and output information. And we know that within this firing pattern, they hide their own computational principles. So we can record these neurons. An example here is like for over 100 years, we've been recording single neurons and activity, neural activity, from an aggregate area. Now, first thing is, yes, we can record it. The other thing that is the cause for thinking that brain equals neurons is that since that these neurons are electrically active, we can manipulate them. We can stick an electrode close to them and apply electricity and change their firing pattern, and with that, change the behavior. And I have here the two examples. Then these are the only two examples that are FDA approved for treating disorders. DBS for Parkinson's disease, dystonia, and TMS that has been approved 4 years ago for depression. That's why I think it comes as a surprise to many to learn that neurons are not the dominant cell in the brain. Depending on brain area, up to 90% of the brain cells are not neurons. So what does this other brain do? Well, even if you look at their names, glial cells, coming from the Greek word for glue, this creates the reasoning behind the misconception that these cells, all they do is that they provide structural and nutritional support to neurons. This is what was the dogma for over 100 years. And the reason for that is that these cells are not electrically silent. Therefore, if we stick electrode, we will see them being silent. They are not responding to anything, or we thought that they do not respond. Until recently, calcium imaging that was developed in 2000 allowed us to see inside the cell how calcium concentration changes as a response to stimulus in these cells. Astrocytes are the most abundant cell in the brain. About 40% of our brain cells are astrocytes. We knew about these cells. This is a drawing by Ramon y Cajal. So he was seeing these cells through the lens of his microscope back in 1897. And he drove them. So we knew about their existence. What we could not see was their function. Until recently, where calcium imaging allowed us to see that these cells are not silent. These cells, what they do is that they use calcium as a signal that takes some kind of information from the periphery, takes it to the soma, to the center, it's being processed and it's sent back to the periphery again. Now there's something more important than that. These cells are not just cells hanging around neurons processing some kind of information. In fact, these cells form their own communication network that uses calcium. In fact, there's something more. The astrocytic component of our brain and the neuronal component of our brain interact with each other. And I'm going to explain to you how these two components of networks interact and exchange information. In fact, the whole brain knot comprises of neuronal and astrocytic networks talking to each other and exchanging information. So I believe now you should expect the reason behind the title. We and others try to establish a field that someone could call computational astroscience, which has two goals. Since this neuronal and astrocytic network are there in the brain, it follows naturally to create biophysically plausible models that help us understand how intelligence, biological intelligence, emerges from this interaction between these two major components. Why we can do that? Because current calcium imaging has limitations. We have experimental data at the cellular level, but computational models are the only road at this point where we can go from the cellular to the network level where behavior and diseases emerge. Now, I believe you understand why I kept the other half of the slide empty. Again, it follows naturally to derive computational principles that astrocytes have and create brain-inspired computing methods, neural astrocytic networks that are applied or have the potential to be applied to generic data analysis. These neural astrocytic networks will give us two advantages that we do not currently have. The first one, they will extend learning beyond the synaptic changes. Everything we are doing, some of you understand, the rest of us are just end users in terms of back propagation. You name everything that is in deep learning, everything that it does is changing these weights between connections. Astrocytes are adding an orthogonal dimension into learning, and I'm going to tell you how. The second advantage that these networks have is that they introduce the notion of time. There are many advantages for having time into a network. I'm going to give you one which is more biologically relevant. If you stick an electrode on my head, in my motor cortex, and you ask me to move my hand as fast as possible, the recording of the neurons will give me a signal of about 500 hertz. 500 times per second would be the firing of the neurons. It's a fast process. My hand, though, will be 2 to 3 hertz, 2 to 3 times. That's the maximum I could do. So time is something that was missing all these years, and astrocytes, having their own dynamics, serve as the bridge between neurons that are fast and behavior that is slow. So in these 40 minutes, I will describe to you three things that we're doing. The first thing is how we're building biophysically plausible models of neural astrocytic networks to understand key points of biological intelligence. The second thing is how we derive computational principles and we build neural astrocytic networks to have the potential to solve problems in artificial intelligence. And the third thing I'm going to describe to you is the framework that we are building to accept this knowledge. And this framework will introduce the notion of robotic behavior emerging from the interaction between neurons. This is where the good news stops. How do you model this? These are the main pathways that exist in the communication between astrocytes, between neurons, and between astrocytes and neurons. actually we don't have to reinvent the wheel. The neuronal paradigm of studying the brain for the last 30 years gave us enough ammunition to solve this problem. In fact, the modeling of the physical phenomenon in computational neuroscience is being approached as a two-direction problem. We either treat the phenomenon that we want to model as something that emerges. So we build biophysics-based models, and so ions, molecules running here and there, and the phenomenon that we want to model emerges from the interaction of these simulated pieces. This is a more difficult approach, and it's been, like one example is the Blue Brain project in European Union. That is not going well. The other approach is to treat that physical phenomenon, say a spike, as a target function. In other words, I don't care what are the underlying mechanisms, all I want to do is to replicate faithfully the end result, what I want to see. For example, the spike activity of neurons. Example that I have been giving is the SPON model, which is a model based on a neural engineering framework, which is essentially a spike-based restricted Boltzmann machine. That's all that it is. And this is an example of how behavior emerges out of the interaction between neurons. That's it. So in the next 6 to 7 minutes, I'm going to describe to you how we are building neural associative networks, what we do. Since astrocytes have their own dynamics, we need that time. And to introduce time into the neuronal component, we need a time-sensitive computational formalin that is called spiking neural networks. Spiking neural nets are what we all have been using as traditional ANNs, with a single difference. We take the arbitrary mapping function that maps the input to the output out, like the circuit, and we replace it with a differential equation that describes how the membrane potential of the neuron would fluctuate in the presence of spikes. So all these spiking neurons do is that they receive input in form of spikes, and these spikes create a temporal trace that you see there, and we add all of them. And if the addition is prominent enough for the neuron, it sends its own information to the neurons that it communicates. So in this way, we could encode the importance of the stimulus, say how, like what's the value of a pixel in terms of a firing rate of a spike. This completes the spiking neural network. So we have our neuronal component of the neural astrocytic network. The second component is the astrocytic component. And then in this talk, we're gonna focus on a single astrocytic process, the one that has been faithfully studied for more than 10 years now, which is a global calcium wave. So if you look at the astrocytes, what they do is periodically, every 10 seconds or so, they send a global calcium wave, but nobody knows what is the role of it. And we model that using the amplitude and the shape. So there's a progenitor cell, a cell that creates that calcium wave. And the further we are away from that cell, the amplitude of the calcium falls, and we also control the shape of the calcium wave as a bioexponential. This is a less aesthetically pleasant, but more scientifically accurate representation of how these waves propagate in space and time. These are the good news now. Synapse. So if you open a book, your physiology book, you will see the synapse being like that. You have a presynaptic neuron, a postsynaptic neuron. Every time there's information coming to the presynaptic terminal in form of spikes. They create something, and the presynaptic terminal releases some molecules called neurotransmitters that they diffuse in that area called synaptic cleft and bind to the receptors of the postsynaptic neuron. And these receptors open up and ion channels go in or out. That's the whole process that you have been emulating in terms of weights in the neural networks. Well, current knowledge distorts this image and introduces a third guy in the party. That's why it's called tripartite synapse. So we're still keeping the presynaptic neuron, the postsynaptic neuron, but the third guy is an astrocytic end food, an astrocyte that unsheaths this synapse. So what does this astrocyte do? It does three things. The first thing it does is that it listens to the neuronal component. These astrocytes have the same receptors that postsynaptic neurons have. In other words, whatever signal goes to the postsynaptic neuron, it's being also received by the astrocyte. So astrocytes, if you give them enough time, they will know what is the neuronal component doing in our network. Now, they do two other important things that can be encapsulated in a single word. They modulate. They modulate the neuronal activity. How? They can stop the presynaptic neuron from sending any information, and they can start talking by themselves to the postsynaptic neuron. They can introduce their own information into the neuronal network.
Yes. If I'm understanding correctly, so the goal is to model the brain or design computational mechanisms to model the brain, right? So the science aspect of it, which designs, models, and hypotheses. What is the end goal of it? Like, what are you trying to figure out of the simulation?
Behavior. How behavior emerges from the neural interaction. I'm not inventing a new goal. I'm following von Neumann's goal.
But correlation is not causation.
I agree. I mean, we can have as many philosophical discussions as you want. I agree. So, you have to digest some math. I'm just going to go through them fast. The first thing we do is we have to respect tradition. So what we have here is an equation that describes how information propagates from the presynaptic neuron to the postsynaptic neuron. Okay, so to do that, since we need to have time into our synapse, we introduce a model that was introduced by TAM. It's called the TAM model from the three authors. And all this model says is that the ability for the information to pass from one neuron to the other is a matter of resources that are in three states. Active, I can deliver the information. Inactive, I've delivered the information, I want my time, I cannot do anything. And recovered, I'm ready, give me information, I'll deliver. And there are three couple differential equations that describe the dynamics of the interaction between these three states. We modeled the ability of a tripartite synapse to stop the presynaptic neuron to talk with a single phenomenological variable, because we could not address all these pathways that I showed you. And this phenomenological parameter, it has its own dynamics. And what this equation actually says is that whenever the calcium rises up to a certain level, the astrocyte can stop the presynaptic neuron from talking. The third part, which is how we make that neuron to receive information from astrocytes, everything that this slide says is whenever the calcium reaches a certain threshold, that don't ask me why, it's been experimentally fit to 196.69 micromoles. Whenever that astrocyte reaches that threshold, it starts injecting current into the postsynaptic neuron. It starts talking to the postsynaptic neuron. So we have everything. We have the information going from the presynaptic neuron to the postsynaptic neuron. We have our ability to stop the presynaptic neuron, and we have our ability to give our own information to the postsynaptic neuron. I'm going to describe to you how we, perhaps it could address Sardo's so what question, right? So what are we doing with this? Brain oscillations. I talked to you in the beginning about David Quine, and I was fortunate to have David as my mentor at Harvard for 2 years, the last 2 years of my postdoc life. And the reason we took this picture is actually hidden here in the background. This is the plot that he donated to MGH Museum, which actually was the plot that proved that his magnetoencephalography works. That was good enough for science to accept his work. In fact, he created the whole field on magnetoencephalography. This is how important our oscillations. And in fact, if you look at the publications, now every 2 to 3 hours, we have a paper coming out only at PubMed, so only medically related, with oscillations. Why? Because oscillations are the building block of encoding and processing information in the brain. Whenever two neural areas want to send information to each other, they get entrained into a single oscillation, and they can translate information from one to the other. In fact, there is not a single brain disease that at least I know that is not associated with oscillatory imbalances. But oscillations are one of the most well-studied for over 100 years. Nobody knows how they arise. What is the mechanistic origin of oscillations? So going back to our NANs, neural associative networks, we built a NAN very similarly to what I described to you. So we built the neuronal component, the spike neuronet. We built an astrocytic layer that emits calcium imaging. We're happy, and we put it to sleep. The neuronal network was doing nothing more than nothing. We just drove the neurons with a basal activity that you would expect to see when someone is not doing anything. So the neuronal component had no function. We put the network to sleep. These oscillations arise as a network property. So if you look at a single neuron, you will see it doing nothing. But if you look at the overall activity of the network, you will see it oscillating because of the interaction between neurons and astrocytes. In fact, you can see the temporal resemblance between our model and studies showing delta oscillation. This is delta oscillation in the brain when humans sleep. Perhaps the resemblance is even more striking in sleeping rats. And the reason for that is that all the parameters that we use are derived from experiments from animal models. Calcium imaging requires the injection of virus into an animal model. Therefore, there are no human studies with calcium imaging. At least we can have a volunteer. So oscillations in our model, delta oscillations, the one that you would expect to see in sleep, are arising as a network property by a neural astrocytic network being put to sleep. I'm going to be honest and always, but we tried to publish that in Nature. After a month, we got a polite response by them saying, thank you, no experimental results, just computational results, no Nature paper. That was their not so hidden message. 2 months after we archived our paper, we got an experimental validation of our work by a group that I had never interacted with, that they published in Nature Scientific Reports. And they said, our experimental data strongly supports this hypothesis, that this hypothesis was reinforced by a recent modeling study showing that interstellar calcium signaling potentially can introduce slow oscillations in neurons, and they had put out archived paper. This is just one example. So, if by introducing astrocytes to a neuronal network and putting it to sleep, we are threatening to scratch the surface of a 100-year-old question, we wonder what would happen if we put astrocytes do something. So we steered our research to Hopfield nets for two reasons. A, they are the precursors of modern neural nets. We can study astrocytes faithfully in Hopfield nets and then perhaps derive what we find into more complicated neural nets. And the second, memories in a Hopfield net are stored in the synapses, in the connections between neurons, where astrocytes and neurons interact. So a Hopfield net is a recursive, fully connected, not shown here, network of binary neurons. And if the connections between them are symmetric, you can think of the whole network having an energy landfill, and every time we store a memory, we create a valley into that energy field. And the neurons in this network, by just looking around their neighbor, local roots, they can decide whether they should change or not their state, so that the whole network will relax to a bottom, like the bottom of one of these valleys, which are the memories, fully recovered memories. So our goal with a neural astrocytic Hopfield net was to see how astrocytes can introduce their own contribution in terms of time to generate sequences of memories. Why we care about sequences of patterns? They're everywhere in biology. For example, when you walk, you generate sequences of patterns. When we train the kids with a pediatric rehabilitation robot, in fact, what we try to do is to train them, learn sequences of patterns that will be translatable to their everyday life. So we started building the network with binary neurons, and sometimes it confused me in conference. Sometimes people hide, although they don't want that. What is their contribution against what has been known? So everything you see as green is our astrocytic contribution. Everything that you see black is either Hopfield's original work or derived from his work. Okay? So we created what they call local field for each one of these neurons that had the neuronal component, the Hopfield's component, and we added to it a contribution from astrocytes. Now this contribution had its own dynamics, and the two major things that astrocytes do is, as you are aware now, they listen to the presynaptic neuron, and how they do that, they increase their calcium weight linearly with respect to the activity of the presynaptic neuron. So the higher the activity, the higher the calcium. And this process has its own dynamics, which we model with this parameter. The other thing they do is that they inject current into the postsynaptic neuron. They modulate the neural component with this. The difference between these two processes is what introduces the notion of time. So without going into the details, we derive that time by making a simple, biologically plausible assumption. The more we rely on the previous calcium state, the less we rely on the input that we're getting from the presynaptic neuron, and vice versa. By doing that, we found a closed form solution of tau, the time, which is better actually to visualize and see the following. If an astrocyte is not confident about what is happening at the neuronal component, it increases the time. This is what we do, right? If we're not confident in taking a decision, we're just waiting. In fact, I've seen that too many times where the neuronal analogy actually maps straight to the behavioral aspect of our brain.
Have you validated, this is a hypothesis, right? So,
oh yeah.
So have you validated the experiment?
You were the reviewer in the Nature, right? I think there are ways to validate, and we are doing it. One of the ways is the behavior emerges. In other words, fine, all these map. Does the network change between memories and that? So the neural associative network changes its memory state, its state, by just having the astrocyte injecting current. So that's one way to validate. It works.
So what is the intuition behind just using the linear approximation?
Let's see.
Intuition.
We scripted that. I'm not kidding. So, although I have to put the disclaimer here that this is not mathematically correct because the weights are not symmetric anymore, you can think of that as a neural associative network creates a volley of memories. And every time we relax on one of these volleys, the astrocyte starts to tilt the energy field, and we're thrown into the next memory, and so on and so forth. How do we train a neural astrocytic network? That's one way that I want to present here today. And it's the simplest way that it works. And I'm not going to say more than that. We're just going to follow all these parameters. That's the learning rate. That's a typical thing. How fast we learn. The second, this is important, the time that we wait until we show to the network the next memory. This needs to be long enough for the astrocytes to sense what is the neuronal component in their calcium activity. S is the postsynaptic state. And the astrocyte, through its calcium, if we wait long enough, time, they sense the presynaptic activity in the previous memory. Someone might say, hey, you told us that this astrocyte senses the presynaptic activity. Now you're telling me that they also sense the postsynaptic activity. Yes. 2004, neuron paper, experimental results. That there is a retrograde signaling between postsynaptic neuron and astrocytes. There is a pathway. There is a way. So we didn't invent it. So what did we discover? We introduce time into a neural associative network, and we introduce a single case where learning is no longer a function of the synaptic weights in terms of a single value. Why? Well, although Hopkins have been around for more than 35 years, neuroscientists now, sometimes they're fast, sometimes they're slow, rediscover that this structure, essentially the whole category of attractor networks is what has been used faithfully to represent how the prefrontal cortex and the hippocampus are organized. Speaking of hippocampus, let's go to the third part. What you see here is a single neuron from a hippocampus. This neuron fires at specific places in this case. So whenever that mouse is at this place or this place or this place, this is when only this and only then that neuron will fire. In fact, this is a great cell, and it's one of the cells that have been experimentally found in the brain that form what we call the biological navigation system. We have a GPS in our brain comprised of neurons, place cells, head direction cells, grid cells. There are other cells as well. In fact, this domain has started in 1971 by John O'Keefe. He got a Nobel Prize 3 years ago. Together with the Moshers, who actually found the grid cell, he was the one who found the place cell. The problem is that experimentalists, all they care is to find and report an activity of a neuron that nobody else has found, publish it to PNAS, and then go to the next paper. They have never thought of proposing a network of these neurons where behavior emerges as the result of the interaction between. So we're building in the lab a brain morphic algorithm, an algorithm that builds on neurons interacting with each other, place cells, grid cells, head direction cells, and other cells that create a network that helps that robotic device simulated, but we also have a real robot in the lab, that can orient itself in a 2D environment. And hopefully, it will be able to find its own way towards its goal. We're getting tired, so let's play a game. So what I'm going to ask you is to read this. Can you read this sentence in two settings? The first experiment, you will be moving your head like that. And the second one, I'll figure it out. I'll find a way to make the second experiment. Are you ready?
No.
Yeah. Can you read this? Yes. Let's do the opposite. So same speed, no movement. So don't move. Much harder, right? So someone would say, well, it's the sucking thickness of the projector. Even if you had an analogy, like if you had a paper, you would still see the same effect. What is happening? And this is your eye trying to do saccadic and pursuit movement as you are reading this. So what is happening is that there are specialized neurons in your brain. So between your ears and your nose, there's a tube. And inside that tube, there's fluid. Inside that fluid, there are some hair follicles. And when you move, due to inertia, your fluid moves, and with that, the hair moves. This is the speed that is encoded in these specialized neurons that inform your eyeball to steer towards the other direction and keep your gaze in the target. This is one example of specialized neurons that exist in the human oculomotor system. Guess what? We try to model this as well and create a robotic head that can track a laser target and you see that this behavior here, Santos, this behavior emerges as the result of only neurons interacting with each other. There is no signal processing. There is no system identification. It's just neurons encoding information, emulating retina, and In fact, this is a quarter of the whole model and the connections that exist. This is just one part that controls this muscle. No, this muscle. So, I told you a few things today. One, if we are to introduce brain-inspired computing, we should actually look at the knowledge in the brain in the last few years. The second thing I told you is it's not only neurons, it's astrocytes as well. The third, I showed you how this approach can actually help us understand one thing in how biological intelligence emerges. Oscillations are important when it comes to intelligence. The fourth thing I told you is, well, if we can derive these computational principles for astrocytes, then we can perhaps create neural astrocytic networks that do something. And the fifth thing that I told you is that we are building a framework that can bridge the behavior to the neural astrocytic networks. So these are the principal components of what we do, the main, and these are the people behind them. So Yanis and Vladimir are actually taking the lead in terms of what we show you, what I showed you today, are astrocytes being modeled as point processes, which is good. Help us understand, but there is something, there is a mystery here. The astrocytes are forming a syncytium, a tile, which is, it's too hard to be randomized in this way. So we are creating geometrical representations of astrocytes, and we see their effect. For example, these astrocytes can actually synchronize neuronal components as they do neural assemblies, as they do capture neural nets, as they do their own stuff. This can synchronize them. Who cares? Well, then you could have a single neuron doing multiple things in different time domains. So I guess even if you don't believe, at least you understand what we want to do. We want to understand biological intelligence, and we want to translate that intelligence to artificial intelligence. I want to thank these two guys. It's not only the results, but sometimes the meta results, the results of the results. There's a big story behind them. Kevin and Leo worked. Leo spent a year and a half with us, so we had the time to corrupt him. And he's now a PhD student at MIT. And this is the new blood, the group. And we gathered around a really brilliant brain so that you don't confuse. This is the brilliant brain, okay? So in addition to the Astro guys, we had the robotic guys. Guangxing and Praveen. Guangxing is staying and is conducting a PhD. Where is he? So he's pushing forward this direction, the biomed robotics direction. And we're not just end users, we build our stuff. So we went from this to that, and this is the most of the work that has been done. Today I presented almost a quarter of the publications that came out of the lab, but this is the most crucial quarter, I think, not only because of its potential, but because it has the potential to actually innervate all our other efforts. So thank you. And if you have any other questions, I would be happy to answer.
We have time for a few questions.
Yeah. Yes?
Modeling interstitial behavior in beyond what you have done now by reducing to multicellular behavior. What are your thoughts?
So, multicellular behavior. Well, the astrocytes do more than just one thing. So we are not going to disregard that they provide nutritional. They provide any kind of support that is needed for neurons. So they provide mitochondria, they provide other things. So, but what we focus is on a specific thing, which is what is the computational role of these signals. I don't know if I did not answer your question.
That was very clear. What I'm referring to is the fluid matrix within which both neurons and astrocytes live, which is another type of tissue, right? And except we don't normally think of it that way, but it is. And so the question is the interstitial component. Obviously, I'm jumping way ahead, but
yes,
still,
exactly.
You have a lifetime of work here.
Yes.
However, have you considered what's your dreaming about dealing with?
You might think of me as being. I just want to do this, and I'm not thinking of something more than that. And the reason is that the brain, as I told you, is not a monolithic structure.
Mm-hmm.
It has so many things that I think it would take. It's like the universe. You'll never finish understanding the universe or seeing it.
Yeah.
So we focus on one thing. We try to understand the basic. I don't think that I will understand something more than that. Let's see what are the basic. Astrocytes have been around for 100 years, at least in our microscopes. Nobody cared what is their computational role. Why?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they didn't. They were not electrically exciting.
But beyond calcium is the question.
Oh, yeah. We have IP3, I think I showed you. So there are other molecules. We model IP3, which is another molecule. We have ATP pathways. ATP is an important pathway. Why? Because it's a very expensive molecule. So whenever the cell needs to use ATP, there should be a good reason for doing that. So there are other pathways. So if you were referring to other pathways inside astrocytes, yes, we do that. We do that. But something outside astrocytes at this point, I think.
You're wisely sticking away from that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
So this traditional model of neural networks for a long time that hasn't changed. So you're introducing another component that's kind of biologically inspired. So what, from the computational perspective, sort of at one level, the cynic would say everything's Turing complete, like you can compute all the same things anyway. What kind of computational advantage does your model predict?
Mm-hmm. I had the slide which was time and learning beyond the synaptic waves. These two are important. And time is something that has been missing for over 100 years. So I gave you the example of motor neurons firing very fast and the behavior emerging at a much slower speed. Astrocytes, having their own dynamics, they introduce time. So they have a middle time scale between the fast neural processing and the slower behavior. I don't know if
are there other computational advantages like learning rate or
the time that we learn
neurons
or
other things
you know, I mean,
that other things here. Or is that your model quite today?
We'll see. But for now no. I'm not hiding anything. I'm open. It's all right.
That's it for the questions.
So tomorrow at noon, we have the CS conference. You're all welcome to come. We have 35 posters, 35 of you guys talking about their own exciting research.
Do we announce this to everyone yet before? We announce it to
through diffusion.
We want to do it. Okay. Good.
So where is it?
Downstairs.
Okay, thanks.